Hi, it's Patrick Cox here with the Hiroshima podcast, part of a series we're calling Hiroshima Generations, with support from the United States Japan Foundation. It's the 70th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bomb, the world's first nuclear attack on August 6th, 1945. It killed roughly 70,000 people instantly and tens of thousands more over time, mainly due to radiation exposure. As you might imagine, the Japanese language has been affected by this. It has quite a lexicon of A-bomb related words. I'll talk a bit about a few of them later in the podcast, but first, a bit of background. 10 years ago, for the 60th anniversary of Hiroshima, long before there was a World in Words podcast, I did a series of reports on atomic bomb survivors and mental health. A lot of research has been done into the physical ailments of survivors, the various forms of radiation sickness and cancers that have afflicted them. But there's been very little research into the survivors' psychological ailments. You can listen to those archive stories, by the way, at our website. Slightly different URL from the one I usually give out. This one is pri.org/Hiroshima. For the 70th anniversary, this time, I wanted to talk with younger people in Hiroshima, younger generations in survivor families, and others, just young people in Hiroshima. I talked to survivors about their relationship with some of these younger people, whether they trust their children and their grandchildren to hold the memory of Hiroshima. And this is something that really plagues survivors, that they feel their memory is unique. You either have it or you don't have it. You lived through this event that's horrifying almost beyond imagination, or you didn't. So what happens when you pass that memory on and entrust it to them? It's a big moment. Also, just before we get into hearing from some of those people in Hiroshima, I'd like to dip into the historical context. The history around the U.S. decision to drop the bomb on an enemy city, targeting civilians, overwhelmingly civilians, this history is unsettled. We really haven't decided what we think about it yet. Just cast back your mind, if you're of a certain age, cast back your mind 20 years ago to the cancellation of the Smithsonian's Enola Gay exhibition. It was cancelled because people, many Americans, could not agree on how we should remember Hiroshima. Now, there's a sort of official narrative, which in the months and years after 1945 was widely supported by the U.S. public. And that narrative goes like this. The U.S. dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, and 3 days later, another bomb on Nagasaki to force Japan into surrendering. And in so doing, it saved untold numbers of American servicemen's lives that would have been otherwise lost had the U.S. been forced to mount an invasion. World War II was successfully brought to a close. That's the narrative. There are counter-narratives too, research that showed that the Japanese were preparing to surrender before Hiroshima and that use of the bomb was therefore unnecessary. And moreover, that the U.S. used its atomic weaponry to show the world that it had that weapon and that it worked, in particular to show the Soviet Union this, to essentially flex its muscle. Aside from that, there's the question of whether the U.S. had the moral authority to use the bomb. Was it a courageous decision that essentially shocked a vicious and deluded Japanese leadership into surrendering, and so saved the lives not just of American servicemen, but many Japanese civilians as well? You hear actually that view coming from a Japanese survivor of Hiroshima in the story that follows. The alternative view when it comes to morality was that Hiroshima was a barbaric act that reflected poorly on the United States. That was the view of former President Dwight Eisenhower, among others. Whatever your view, I hope that you will listen to this story and any other stories that you hear about Hiroshima with an open mind. All the reporting that I've done, this and other stories, has been about people who were children when the bomb was dropped. They're all people, they and later generations in their family, they're all people who are living one way or the other with the consequences of the bombing. And those are consequences that we should all know about, whether or not we think the bombing was justified. It seems the more we know, the more we're able to decide where this piece of history sits. Anyway, here goes with today's story. Hiroshima's Peace Park, created in 1954, is right next to the hypocenter of the blast. It's a draw for tourists and Japanese school groups, though not as much of a draw as it used to be. Volunteer tour guides, some of them relatives of survivors, show visitors around, There's a museum, an eternal flame, a peace bell. On a recent afternoon here, two men are sitting on a bench, deep in conversation. One is elderly. He sports a narrow-brimmed fedora. The other, in a hoodie, looks like he's barely out of college. It's so beautiful here in the Peace Park, the young guy says. So hard to imagine what it must have been like. The old guy says this used to be a bustling part of town, lots of bars and restaurants. All that's left now are a few ruins, most prominently a building now known as the Atomic Bomb Dome. Before 1945, it was an exhibition hall. The two men are sitting right next to it. My father used to work here, says the old guy. When I was little, I used to play inside the building. I'd slide down the banister. My Japanese interpreter figures it out first. The old man is a hibakusha, a survivor of the blast, and the young guy is a volunteer guide here at the Peace Park. We ask the old man his name, Noriho Azuma. Then there's the question you always ask. Where were you when the bomb exploded? I was 17 and should have been at school, he says. But school had been cancelled. We'd been ordered to work in a factory. The factory walls protected Azuma from the blast. The rest of his family survived too. I don't have radiation sickness, he says. For some reason, my health wasn't affected. All the same, it would have been much better if I'd died back then. Life has been hard. My friends all died young. Azuma returns to his conversation with the young guide. Some people blame the United States for dropping the bomb, Azuma tells the guide. But I think if the Americans hadn't dropped the bomb, it might have been even crueler, because the Japanese government was calling on everyone to fight, even women and children, if the Americans invaded, to fight them with homemade bamboo swords. Can you imagine? Maybe dropping the bomb was immoral, but we did surrender after that. The young guy doesn't agree. Take a look at history, he says. The war didn't end because of the atomic bomb. It's a brief moment of discord. Mainly, these two are full of admiration for each other. When I came here today, I saw this young guy, Azuma says, pointing to his new friend. I saw this guide talking so knowledgeably to visitors, so I approached him and told him he was doing a great job. The young guide's name is Masaki Murakami. He says when he first became a guide, he just showed people around without explaining much. Truth be told, he was just doing it to improve his English skills. But then an older guide he knew started educating him, he says. She showed him sketches of Hiroshima in the wake of the blast. They were drawn by atomic bomb survivors. Murakami tells me about one of the sketches, which showed several fires. I thought it was buildings on fire. But the older guide, he says, she explained to me that these were bodies being burned, huge piles of bodies. That really shocked me. I realized I'd never before seriously thought about war. Just as Murakami is telling me this, he spots the very woman he's been talking about, the older guide. There she is over there, he says. She's a denshosha, a memory keeper. It means she's related to a survivor who has died, and now she tells that survivor's story. This woman's in her 50s, pushing a bike. She walks over. Murakami explains to her that he was just telling us about the sketch she had showed him. The woman pulls out a folder. It has more sketches by survivors, some photos too.
This is my mother. At that time, my mother, 3.5 kilometers from the hypocenter and survived a bomb. But my mother's sister died, Atsuko, died in the bombing.
This guide's name is Michiko Yamaoka. She says she's been volunteering here for 7 years.
7 years ago, I couldn't speak English, but it's very important to speak English because many tourists come to here. So I study English very hard since then.
Yamaoka is the mother of a boy and a girl, both now grown up.
My children, they are very busy, so they cannot talk about my mother's story. It's very sad for me.
This is a widespread problem. The younger generation, even within survivor families, are often distracted with daily life. They don't get involved. Hiroshima's team of volunteer guides is graying, which is why Michiko Yamaoka, the memory keeper, and Noriho Azuma, the survivor, are so excited by the eagerness of this young guide in his early 20s. He doesn't even have any family connection to the A-bomb. He's from a neighboring prefecture, but he's interested. Azuma tells him again, "You're an excellent guide. I wish there were more like you." Masaki Murakami replies, "Yeah, other young people, they just can't relate to the story of the A-bomb. Most guides are retirees. Who's going to do the job when they get too old?" Azuma, the survivor, says it's difficult for anyone who didn't go through it to truly understand what happened here. He tells the young guide, "It's a good thing you don't have to experience such a tragedy." And with that, they go their separate ways. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox. We have a bunch more online, photos of everyone featured in this story, a reproduction also of the drawing that so moved Masaki Murakami, the young guide. Video too. You can find all of that at pri.org/Hiroshima. I've also posted it at the usual place, pri.org/language. I mentioned a whole lexicon of atomic bomb-related words. Here are just a few. The most famous word is the one that came up in the story, hibakusha. That's usually literally translated as bomb-affected people or explosion-affected people. In other words, A-bomb survivors. Then there are the four official categories of hibakusha. And here is where I'm going to have to apologize for my pronunciation. I do not speak a word of Japanese. So ahead of time, sorry. The first category is chokubaku, which is someone who was directly exposed to the bomb, either in Hiroshima or Nagasaki. And they had to be within 2.2 kilometers of the hypocenter. The next one is, and I'm really going to mess this pronunciation up, nuishi hibaku. That is someone who was exposed to radiation when he or she entered a 2 kilometer radius of the hypocenter, anytime within 2 weeks of the blast. The third category is kyogo hibaku. A lot of rescue and relief workers, they were given this designation. You didn't have to be close to the hypocenter, but you might nonetheless have been exposed to radiation in your relief work. And the final category is tainai hibaku. That is anyone who was exposed to radiation but not born. They were still in utero. These categories determine many things in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, not least your right to extra healthcare checkups and admission to hibakusha hospitals. One other word that I mentioned in the story, this came up quite a bit during my time in Hiroshima, denshosha, memory keeper. And you could be more specific if you want and say hibak denshosha, a memory keeper of someone affected by the bomb. There are going to be three other stories from Hiroshima that I reported that are coming out this week. Those three stories really have no language dimension to them, so I'm not going to include them in future episodes of this podcast, but I do hope you'll listen to them. I'll post links at the website. They'll also be available to anyone who subscribes to the podcast called PRI's The World Latest Edition. If you listen to that podcast, I'll be back in a day or two with another story from Hiroshima, this one about a survivor who lost her entire family in the blast but rebuilt her life, and she's now dealing with the challenge of having her granddaughter marry an American serviceman. Otherwise, I'll be back with a World in Words podcast in a couple of weeks. Thanks very much for listening.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.